This is the funeral song for the kings of Israel. And it starts right out that way. So I'm going to read Ezekiel 19, the whole chapter, 14 verses, and then we'll go over it in the two big sections that it has. And this is God now again coming to Ezekiel. And as I read and study during the week, I keep seeing people talking about this. Well, Ezekiel said, this is God saying. This is not Ezekiel. Ezekiel is like the scribe here. He's just taking dictation because this is not Ezekiel coming up with these things. This is God saying, I want you to do this, Ezekiel, and I want you to do that, and I want you to do it this way. And so what Ezekiel is writing is from the mouth of God, and it's important that we get that. So here's the text. Moreover, take thou up a lamentation for the princes of Israel and say, what was thy mother? A lioness. She crouched among lions. In the midst of the young lions, she nourished her whelps. And she brought up one of her whelps. He became a young lion, and he learned to catch the prey. He devoured men. The nations also heard of him. He was taken in their pit, and they brought him with hooks unto the land of Egypt. Now, when she saw that she had waited and her hope was lost, then she took another of her whelps and made him a young lion, and he went up and down among the lions. He became a young lion, and he learned to catch the prey. He devoured men. And he knew their palaces and laid waste their cities, and the land was desolate, and the fullness thereof because of the noise of his roaring. Then the nations set against him on every side from the provinces, and they spread their net over him. He was taken in their pit, and they put him in a cage with hooks, and they brought him to the king of Babylon. They brought him into strongholds that his voice should no more be heard upon the mountains of Israel. Thy mother was like a vine in thy blood, planted by the waters. It was fruitful and full of branches by reason of many waters, and it had strong rods for the scepters of them that bear rule, and their stature was exalted among the thick boughs, and they were seen in their heights with the multitude of their branches. But it was plucked up in a fury, it was cast down to the ground, and the east wind dried up its fruit. Its strong rods were broken off and withered. The fire consumed them. And now it is planted in the wilderness, in a dry and thirsty land, and fire is gone out of the rods of its branches. It hath devoured its fruit, so that there is in it no strong rods to be a scepter to rule. This is a lamentation and shall be for a lamentation. Now, this is an allegory in a poetical form. And the challenge for me is to take apart this and look at who these kings are and what did they do, so to match up with this funeral dirge here. But again, this is something that would have been sung by those that loved God back then for the passing of Judah, the passing of the southern kingdom. This was the end of Israel as it was losing its sovereignty, and it would lose its sovereignty until May the 15th, 1948. And it got it back. And we're going to see that in the next chapter where there's a promise of that. But we know that the northern 10 tribes fell to the Assyrians in 722 B.C., and Nebuchadnezzar took out the remaining two tribes, Judah and Benjamin, in 586 B.C., after he'd been there a couple other times. The Babylonians, under Nebuchadnezzar, sacked him three times, and they finally took him out. So this is a long time, 722. And then finally, 586, and this is the end of the end for this. So the text starts out with, moreover, take up thou lamentation for the princes of Israel and say, what was thy mother? A lioness. She crouched among lions in the midst of the young lions. She nourished her whelps. Now, the word in Hebrew for a funeral song or a dirge, if you will, was a kina. Kina. Take up this kina for the princes of Israel. And if we can think back to chapter 2, one of the things that God had Ezekiel do was to take this scroll and eat it. And that was one of the first images that we get of what it is that God wants him to show to people that were coming to visit him in Babylon there. It was the elders of Israel. Now, they had already been taken captive, the second and the first invasion. So Ezekiel would entertain these guys and come in, and God has given him these prophecies. And one of them was, I want you to eat this scroll. I want you to eat this scroll. And the scroll was written therein, lamentations, mourning, and woe for the nation Israel. Now, this chapter can be viewed as a conclusion, if you will, to the first part of this book of Ezekiel. And there's two allegorical dirges here. It means a story that represents something in a poetical form. Now, the first one is verses 1 to 9, and the second one is for the people of Israel. First one's for the kings. The second one in verses 10 to 14 are for the people of Israel. Remember what we said earlier, that the people of Israel represented the kings that they were given. The people in general were no better than the king. It wasn't like they had an oppressive king. Although he was, or they were, if you will, oppressive to the few that were righteous. Now, even though the present king was Zedekiah, this is pretty much passed over him. And the funeral song is going to go over the end, if you will, the crumbling Davidic dynasty. David's dynasty is finally crumbling here. And we're going to look at four of these kings. And then the fifth one is like the father of these folks. That would be Josiah. We're going to look at him because he's referenced here. But he wasn't one of the bad guys. He was one of the good guys. The use of the word prince here, it's Nagid. Nagid. It means king. It means royalty. You know, we would look at it and say, well, gee, the prince is only somebody that's underneath the king. But that's not how the Jews make reference to it. They're referring to somebody of a high-ranking royalty. Because we see in Daniel 9:25, the Lord Jesus is referred to as HaMashiach Nagid. The Messiah, King, Messiah the Prince, Messiah the Prince. So it's got a double reference. It just means a person of high royal stature as a king. And the complete dirge here traces the fate of the two kings before Zedekiah, Jehoahaz and Jehoiachin. There are other dirges in the Bible. The largest one is the whole book of Lamentations. I mean, all of those chapters are in this poetical dirge form because Jeremiah is just wailing about what had happened to Jerusalem. It hurt so bad to the country that he loved and nobody would listen to him. And that is really hard to take. And it comes through in this book of Lamentations. And then there's another one. It's shorter. And there's a few very, very short ones. There's another one in the book of Amos where in verses 8 and 9 of chapter 8, or 8 to 10, he prophesies that Israel's sun will set at midday and all songs will change to dirges. And he's referring to this time that's in our text today. He's referring to this. So the dirge shows the last of the kings that are going to follow Josiah after his death. Josiah was a wonderful king. Had he not been killed by Pharaoh Necho's army on the battlefield of Megiddo, he would have enacted more reforms. So the people that loved him had hope in him that he was going to do a lot. He had cut down the high places where the idol worship was. He had killed off the temple prostitutes. He reinstituted the Mosaic Law. He had done a lot of good things. But when Pharaoh Necho was in the northern part of Israel, was going to battle with Nebuchadnezzar, the Battle of Carchemish, and that battle realigned the countries in the Middle East at that time. It was a huge realignment, but very similar to what happened in the First World War. There's a lot of countries that were in Europe, for example, before the First World War that weren't there afterwards. They were all broken up. Everything changed. Well, that's what happened with Carchemish. For some reason, it's hard to understand this. It is for me anyway. Josiah, who wasn't even part of this, gets his army and he goes up into the valley of Megiddo, or where the mountain of Megiddo is, to fight. He wasn't even part of the battle. Maybe he thought that he should probably get involved in this because if they're going to be dividing up the Middle East here, he ought to have some say. And he got killed. He died on the battlefield where the final battle will happen in what we call the Campaign of Armageddon. It's really a mistranslation. Megiddo is a mountain. The word for mountain and just mountain is Har in Hebrew. Har Megiddo. And people mistranslate that, mispronounce it as Armageddon. It's not. But it sticks. So everybody continues to say that. Armageddon's coming. And then they assign Armageddon to all kinds of crazy things, which it's not. It's a mountain next to this battlefield. So Josiah dies, and if you look at the chart there that I put into your notes, you can see that he reigned for 31 years. He dies in 609. Jehoahaz is one of his sons, and he gets placed on the throne, and he only makes it for 3 months. Okay? He's taken prisoner to Egypt by Pharaoh Necho. Then Jehoiakim, and I put in parentheses these other names that they have because it gets confusing reading through the historical narrative in 1 and 2 Kings and 1 and 2 Chronicles because they're referenced in different ways. And, you know, we all have more than one name. You got a first name and a last name and a middle name, and then you got nicknames and so on. So it's not unusual. It's just when you're looking at these Hebrew names and you're reading the text, it gets confusing trying to sort this out. So Jehoiakim, he comes in as king, and he lasts for 11 years. Now, he doesn't get carted away, but he's killed. He is killed in Jerusalem. Then Jehoiachin gets put on the throne, and he only makes it for 3 months. That's all he lasts. He's taken prisoner to Babylon by Nebuchadnezzar, and he stays there the rest of his life. He's a relatively young guy when he goes, too, but we'll touch on that in, when we get into that section. And then finally, as you know, Zedekiah, another one of Josiah's sons, gets put on the throne as a vassal, another vassal king by Nebuchadnezzar. And then the end of Judah, the southern kingdom, is with him. He's the last king. Now, the question the Lord asks is, what was thy mother? And then there was a typo. I've got a question mark after a lioness. It shouldn't be a question mark there. It's just a statement. Your mother was a lioness. It's a reference to the personification of the tribe of Judah. And if we can think back to Genesis 49, the end of Jacob's life, he's got his 12 kids and he's got Joseph's two sons there. He's on his deathbed and he's making prophecies over all of them. And Judah, specifically, he calls a lion. He said, Judah is a lion's whelp. That means a cub. From the prey, my son, thou art gone up. He stooped down, he crouched as a lion. Now, he's talking about some of Judah's life, but more importantly, the tribe of Judah and what would happen to them. He goes on to say that I have included here that the Messiah is going to come through him. The Messiah came through the line of Judah. That's why the Lord Jesus is called the Lion of the Tribe of Judah. He is the Lion of the Tribe of Judah. But here, in this text, it's just saying he's a lion's cub. And there's other verses that identify Judah with a lion, too. And I put those into your notes. Isaiah 29:1, it's used to refer to Jerusalem, which was the center city within the region of Judah. But the because the last vestiges of the tribe of Judah was the southern, was Jerusalem. I mean, that was the prize. Jerusalem's the prize. And it suffered that final deportation to Babylon by Nebuchadnezzar. So the text here in verse 2 describes Judah as a lioness. She crouched among lions. In the midst of the young lions, she nourished her whelps. What does that mean? Well, lions were very popular in the Mideast back at the time of Ezekiel and the kings. They really were there. You know, we think of them as being African, and you just think, well, gee, there were lions there? Yes, there were lions there, and they're easily referenced throughout the entire Old Testament. They were referenced as being in the Jordan. They were referenced as being on Mount Hermon, which is the highest mountain in Israel, and in the Judean desert. But this is a reference to the southern kingdom of Judah. And the female gender, the lioness, is a reference to the gender of Jerusalem. And remember now, all Hebrew nouns have gender. Just what they do. It's like, you know, German does the same thing. It assigns gender to nouns. German has got a neutral, neuter, if you will. And Hebrew doesn't do that. Hebrew assigns a gender to every noun. All cities and countries are given a feminine gender. So that's where this lioness comes from. We're referring to Jerusalem here. We're referring to Judah. And it says here that the whelps were the descendants of the house of David that became corrupt by the neighboring nations. They married into these Canaanite tribes, and starting with Solomon. Solomon was terrible. He started off good, but then he started making these alliances with all these other countries and brought their pagan practices in. He thought it was going to benefit them. Bringing the world in to the purity of God's plan, the practices of the world, pollutes it. It doesn't enhance it. The Apostle Paul makes that real clear in the New Testament. Bad company corrupts good morals. It never goes the other way. Never goes the other way. I've heard people say, and other pastors say, you know, I'm trying to keep these young girls and these young boys in my congregation away from these pagan people. But they say, well, I'll witness to him or I'll witness to her. No, you won't. He's going to pollute you. It goes the other way. It never goes the way you're talking. It always goes the other way. So the first poem here presents a lioness's cub, and that represents this first king on your chart on the left-hand side, King Jehoahaz. He was captured, and he was brought to Egypt. He went to Egypt. Now, he was captured by Pharaoh Necho. He succeeded his father, Josiah, in 609, and he was taken to Egypt. He was replaced by Jehoiakim, and that Jehoiakim, he reigned as what we call a vassal king. In other words, Nebuchadnezzar said, you can stay on the throne, but you're going to do what I want. And he's really not made reference here to the dirges. And we think, although we're not 100% sure, that that is because he was never carted away. He stayed right there. Although it was Nebuchadnezzar's forces that killed him, took him off the throne. So he's replaced by his son. His son. So Jehoiakim, if you will, is a brother of Josiah. He's a brother of Josiah. And so Jehoiakim dies. He's replaced by his son, Jehoiachin. And he's referenced as the second cub in the dirge. And like Jehoiahaz, he only reigns 3 months. He only makes it for 3 months, and then he's taken away to Babylon. And the second dirge looks at, the first one now covers these kings, and the second one starts in verse 10, and it's going to cover the people of Israel. So the people of Israel, under the last king, Zedekiah, and this particular dirge is not going to even talk about Zedekiah. He's going to talk about the people. But they're under him, and he's one of the reasons why they're having all these problems. He was the brother of Jehoahaz, and he was another son of Josiah. He was gifted the throne. Nebuchadnezzar put him on the throne. And Nebuchadnezzar made him a vassal king and said, look, you do what I say, and you got free reign. Go ahead, have at it. And he did okay for a short while, and then he rebelled, which is just terrible. Should have never done that. But he's the one that brought in the final destruction in 586 B.C. So let's look at the next two verses. We're talking about this lion's whelp. And she brought up one of her whelps. He became a young lion. They learned to catch the prey. He devoured men. The nations also heard of him. He was taken in their pit, and they brought him with hooks unto the land of Egypt. So the first successor, if you will, after Josiah dies on that battlefield, is one of his sons. And he gets taken away 3 months later. 3 months later. Now you got to wonder, what was Necho doing? Why did Necho do that? So, you know, a lot of this you can't understand some of their motives. Maybe he was just mad at Josiah. Who knows? For Josiah coming up there, because Necho said to Josiah when he came up to battle at Megiddo, he says, what are you doing here? This isn't your fight. And Josiah gets killed. So he may have been angry with the whole Judean dynasty and decides, I'm going to take the next guy out. So it's really not clear what exactly happened there. But this Jehoahaz here, he was a wicked, wicked guy. It goes back to this idea that righteous people can have wicked children and vice versa. You do your best, but you're not responsible. They are responsible to God once they become adults. And the best you can do is to train them up in the way that they should go. That's the best you can do. Everybody has personal responsibility to God. Every individual. You can't say, well, they're doing it to God for me. They're doing something for me. My dad does that. I don't have to. Really? No, everybody is personally responsible to God. So his wickedness catches the attention of the adjacent nations, and they decided they were going to stop him. So they brought him to Egypt. He was brought there in a humiliating way. The way kings did back then, and they do that somewhat today, too, in armed conflicts. It depends, you know, on how mad you are. But the pit here was this, was a camouflaged hole that they would trap animals in. And that's what they're saying. Sometimes the Bible references this pit in a figurative manner. You know, let's say the kid is at home. He's grounded. He's, oh, I'm in the pit for the whole day. You know, and that's referenced in those Psalms that I put there in Proverbs in your notes. Now, hooks were used to lead captives into exile. Now, I've got a quote here. I think it's Ashurbanipal. I'm not sure, but it's a Syrian king boasting here of how he treated a captive vassal king. What he says here, I pierced his cheek with the sharp-edged spear, my personal weapon, by laying the very hands on him which I had received to conquer opposition against me. I put the ring to his jaw, placed a dog collar around his neck, and made him guard the bar of the east gate of Nineveh, which is called Nirib Masnach Adonate. Later, I had mercy upon him and granted him life in order to praise the glory of Asher and Ishtar and the great gods, my Lord. So he poked holes in his cheek and they put a big ring through his mouth and they led him away with that. That's what they did. And here's this dirge saying it was going to happen. So Jehoahaz was taken to Egypt in a very humiliating way. And God does this to provide an example and humiliation to these people. They were given every opportunity to be righteous. They had the best of what God could ever offer, choosing that nation out of all the nations of the world. And they rejected him. The people of Judah had a false hope that this guy might come back. And they thought about this a couple of different times because he was only on the throne for 3 months. He gets taken away to Egypt and he didn't die right away. He lived a long life, but they thought, well, maybe he's coming back. Maybe he's going to come back. So King Jehoiakim, the next one, that is on your chart right underneath Josiah, is passed over in this dirge. He's not really mentioned here, probably because he lived his life out in Jerusalem. He wasn't taken away captive, but he was killed by Nebuchadnezzar. Jehoiachin is presented next. And when the false hope of Jehoahaz coming back, well, maybe he's going to come back, maybe he's going to be, never materialized regarding the restoration of Jehoahaz from Egypt. Jehoiachin succeeded Jehoiakim upon his death. So they kept waiting for him to come back, but he didn't. So Jehoiachin becomes king. And the text moves on. Now, when she saw that she had waited and her hope was lost, then she took another of her whelps and made him a young lion and went up and down among the lions. He went up and down among the lions. He became a young lion and he learned to catch the prey. He devoured men. Now, remember now, the lioness is Judah or Jerusalem. That's in reference here. And she had waited. She had hoped, and that hope was maybe Jehoiakim is going to come back, but he never did. So Pharaoh appoints Jehoiakim to the throne with the approval of the people. So the mother, the lioness here, she affirms the ascension of Jehoiakim to the throne after realizing that Jehoiakim is not going to come back. He gets removed from office after 11 years by Nebuchadnezzar, and Jehoiachin succeeds Jehoiakim. Same way, same thing. They're hoping Jehoahaz is going to come back still, but he doesn't because they're all, you know, he's still alive. They must have had communication between Egypt and Jerusalem. And they keep thinking, well, he's alive. Maybe he's going to come back. So they're continuing to hope here that this is going to come back. Now, Jeremiah, the prophet, is going to dispel this. He's going, no, he's not coming back. He's not. But they didn't listen to Jeremiah much. They didn't listen to hardly any of the prophets. They wanted what they wanted instead of listening to God's chosen people, bringing his message to them. Now, Jehoiachin here never achieved the status of a full-grown lion because he only reigned for 3 months, too. only reigns for 3 months. Now, it's interesting. This term that's used in this dirge here about going up and down among the lions represents his fluctuating loyalties. He was, I'll do what you want. I like you. No, I don't like you. I like you. No, I don't like you. And he just caused instability, a terrible amount of instability. And when you've got a powerful politician that is causing that kind of instability, you've got massive problems with relationships between countries. And there's a Hebrew word form here that's used in this word or these words going up and down. It's what we call a reflexive verb. For example, if I said, I'm playing baseball, let's say, and I hit the ball, okay? That's an active verb. I'm acting on the ball. I hit it. I hit the ball. A passive verb is one where I say, well, the ball was hit by me. I bring the ball out first, and then I say, what happened to it? I hit it. So active and passive. Active, I hit. Passive, the ball was hit by me. A reflexive verb, though, is one in which I do the action and I receive the action. Classic example, I shave myself. So I'm doing the action, I'm receiving the action. Well, here, the use of that verb gives us some more insight into what's going on here. It's a reference to Jehoiachin's self-driven, self-interest, all for himself, the actions that he's doing, apart from God. That's what God is saying. You're so self-interested. Everything you do is for you, on your whims, and you're ruining the relationships with these other countries because you can't get stable. You're constantly doing things for you. That's that reflexive verb, you see. The heat pe'el, that's the name they give it in Hebrew. You're just doing things for you. In other words, you are selfish, man. You're not doing anything for this country, and you're ruining the relationships with the neighbors. And then the phrase goes on, and he learned to catch the prey. He devoured men. It's a reference to his wickedness. He would go on these rampages, just shedding blood in the kingdom there. A lot of them did this. It was just crazy what they did. It's like, if you've ever seen anybody that gets a powerful position for the first time and doesn't know how to handle it, they turn into tyrants until somebody stops them. It's like, there's power in lots of money. Power. And a lot of people that get money that haven't had it before don't know what to do with it, and they destroy their lives and the people around them. The stories would fill books about the people that won the lottos. And the stories will fill books that you can see about the movie stars, that they suddenly get immensely wealthy and their lives just go right down the tube. It's power. People get corrupted by power, and these guys did that. And this one, particularly, was so self-interested that he ruined the relationships around him. And he only lasted 3 months. So, let's see how Jehoiachin ends, and it's not good. And he knew their palaces and laid waste their cities, and the land was desolate in the fullness thereof because of the noise of his roaring. Then the nations set against him on every side from the provinces, and they spread their net over him. He was taken into their pit, and they put him in a cage with hooks, and they brought him to the king of Babylon. They brought him into the strongholds that his voice should no more be heard upon the mountains of Israel. He is taken to Babylon, and he's replaced. He went to Babylon, and he lived there for a long time. Even near the end of his life, Nebuchadnezzar releases him from prison and treats him well. Treats him well. Just one of the activities that caused people to think that Nebuchadnezzar was actually saved later in his life as a result of Daniel. One of the, because this is a representation of somebody that would be saved, that would do something like this. Now, this guy killed many men in Judah, and he violated their widows. He destroyed the cities. He just ruined the societies. The social fabric was just devastated because of him. And again, he had these fluctuating loyalties. And because of that, the nations around him gathered together under the Babylonians and said, no, you got to take this guy out. We all hate him. We all hate him. He says one thing and he does something else. And none of it makes any sense. The narrative here shows how these adjacent nations came together, though. They were under the Babylonians, and it's found, like, there's a passage in 2 Kings 24:2 that shows how the former person, Jehoiakim, was taken away by the, or was, you know, shall we say, strategized against by the nations. And the same nations did the same thing to Jehoiachin. Moabites, Ammonites, Syrians, under the Babylonians, but the Babylonians were the strongest. And they all aligned with the Babylonians, says, take them out, Nebuchadnezzar. You got the wherewithal. We can't stand them. We can't stand them. So they did. So like the first cub, he is said to have been trapped in the pit and taken away with hooks. But the second was put in a cage, and it's not clear exactly what this means, but it has reference to some of the demeaning practices that the invading or conquering army would impose upon the head people of the government that they were taking out to humiliate them. He was finally placed in this restraint, whatever it was, in a cage of some sort, and he was taken to Babylon. Finally, he was released at age 55. And he was a young guy when he was taken. But when he was released, they kept him there in Babylon. They never let him go back. And they made sure that his children were not going to go back either. They got his kids. Because they didn't want him going back and being popular and setting up a dynasty that was going to oppose Babylon. I mean, that was one of the reasons why they did these humiliating things, is to stop the insurrections, if you will. Make an example of them. The Romans did things similar. I mean, that's what the Romans did with crucifixion. The insurrectionists, the people that were rising up against them, would get crucified and they would put their bodies on these crosses and leave them there until the birds picked away at the flesh and made an example. You know, you become terrorists and you have issues against us, this is where you're going to end up. We're stronger than you. That's what the Babylonians did too. Anyway, he never returned to Jerusalem. And as a text states, that his voice should no more be heard upon the mountains of Israel. And it wasn't. Now, the last segment of this, I'll close with this section here. It's a discussion about the people of Israel. The people of Israel, represented by the vine. And we've seen that in other chapters, the representation of the vine. This was during Zedekiah's reign, the last king. So the text says, thy mother was like a vine, and thy blood planted by the waters. It was fruitful and full of branches by reason of many waters. And it had strong rods for the scepters of them that bear rule. And their stature was exalted among the thick boughs. And they were seen in their height with the multitude of their branches. So the allegory moves away from a lion now, and it's lifting it up. It says, your mother, the lion's mother, was like a vine. So we're talking about Israel now. It's getting a little broader. So the entire theme of this lamentation here is about the princes and the lion cubs, that the way that they turned away from God, and they were wicked in the way that they ran the government at Jerusalem. And the Davidic dynasty is now coming to an end. This is what this dirge is all about here. It's the funeral march for the end of David's dynasty. The end of it. And to make this point here that this is the end, Ezekiel changes the metaphor from a lion to the vine and its strongest stem. The strongest stem. The vine is represented as the mother. That's Jerusalem and Israel. And it's planted by many waters. That's the flourishing of this vine by God's nurturing, God's choosing them. And the vine flourishes and it brings forth big boughs and big fruit. That's God's blessing. The structure of the vine is strong and it's got these thick boughs and they grow high and there's many branches. And if you think back to when we were looking at the vine here, even in, you know, chapter 16 and 17, that the best time for Israel was under Solomon. That was when the vine representing Israel had its best flourishing, the most fruit. Everything was reached its height. The vine metaphor has been used in chapter 15, 17, 18, Isaiah 24, Jeremiah 2. And I put a psalm in your notes here to describe this. And it pulls this whole concept of the vine being Israel together. Psalm 80, verses 8 to 11 said, "Thou broughtest a vine out of Egypt." That's the Jews coming out of Egypt after the 400-year captivity. "Thou didst drive out the nations and plantedest it. Thou preparedest room before it and took deep root and filled the land. The mountains were covered with the shadow of it, and the boughs thereof were like the cedars of God. It sent out its branches unto the sea, and its shoots unto the river." Unto the river. So it's a reference to Israel, again, coming out of Egypt, going into the promised land, chasing out the nations that were there, at least moving them aside, and planting the Jews there. And this is Psalm saying, "God, you did this." So now the vine in this passage in Ezekiel is referencing the decline and fall of Judah's people. It had the potential to be great. The healthy vine is also representative of good King Josiah that I put into your chart there. He was Zedekiah's father, and he was a fine, fine man and a fine example of what a godly man and a godly king should be. Zedekiah had the potential to be his equal, but he became wicked. He became wicked. And this is the final destruction in verses 12 to 14. "But it was plucked up in fury, and it was cast down to the ground, and the east wind dried up its fruit. The strong rods were broken off and withered. The fire consumed them. And now it is planted in the wilderness in a dry and thirsty land. The fire is gone out of the rods of its branches. It has devoured its fruit so that there is in no strong rod to be a scepter to rule. This is a lamentation and shall be for a lamentation." So Josiah, the good king, gives a sons here that turn into wicked kings. And it was predicted in Deuteronomy 29:27. So Nebuchadnezzar comes, slaughters the royal people. The vine withers. The house of Josiah is gone. Kingdom of Israel is over. And this vine gets planted in the desert, which is over into Iraq, over into Babylon, where there's no water. In other words, the goodness of the Lord is not nurturing them there like it was. The cause of the vine's final destruction was sin. And the sins of the leaders, the sins of the country, and Zedekiah's rebellion against God gets delivered in a final message from Jeremiah. Jeremiah had warned them. And this is the final message to the king about you're over, you're done. And in Jeremiah 34, the first five verses read, "The word which came unto Jeremiah from Jehovah, when Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and all his army, and all the kingdoms of the earth, were under his dominion, and all the peoples were fighting against Jerusalem and against all the cities thereof, saying, Thus saith Jehovah, the God of Israel, Go and speak to Zedekiah, king of Judah, and tell him, Thus saith Jehovah, Behold, I will give this city into the hand of the king of Babylon, and he shall burn it with fire. Thou shalt not escape out of his hand, but shall surely be taken and delivered into his hand. And thine eyes shall behold the eyes of the king of Babylon, and he shall speak with thee mouth to mouth, and thou shalt go to Babylon. Yet hear the word of Jehovah, O Zedekiah, king of Judah. Thus saith Jehovah concerning thee, Thou shalt not die by the sword. Thou shalt die in peace and with burnings of thy fathers, the former kings that were before thee. So shall they make a burning for thee, and they shall lament thee, saying, O Lord, for I have spoken the word, saith Jehovah. And that ended the sovereignty of the nation Israel. It finally was over. And that's this dirge that gets sung over this, as if the funeral has been granted and it's all over. Whew. Wow. And it has parallels in other countries all over the world, but none have been nurtured like Israel. Directly ordained by God and given so many blessings. Makes me look at this country, you know, and see how many blessings we've had here. This is the greatest country on the face of this earth, the United States of America. There's never been a country that is as wealthy, as free. It just has so much, and it's going down fast. It's going down fast. Let's pray.